This episode of The Lou Rockwell Show is sponsored by...
Do you want liberty in your lifetime? The Free State Project is our best chance. We are people who know that liberty will not be achieved by more of the same tactics and are committed to a strategy that will work. Check us out on the web at freestateproject.org. That's freestateproject.org.
This is The Lou Rockwell Show.
Dr. Guido Holzman, thanks for coming on the show this morning. Guido is professor of economics at the University of Angers in France. He's head of the economics department there, senior fellow at the Mises Institute, author of his most recent books in English, Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism and the Ethics of Money Production. Guido, we know that thanks to Greenspan and Bernanke, we've had some pretty unethical monetary production going on in the U.S., but obviously the U.S. is not the world, thank goodness. What's happening in Europe with money production?
Very similar thing, so it's also quite unethical. At least if our standard is overall well-being, that is, if we keep in mind the well-being of the population and not of the financial markets and governments, then, of course, this policy had some justification. Well, in Europe, they also expanded the money supply, the base money supply, very strongly, although not quite as strongly as in the U.S., and this had two objectives. On the one hand, this is a general objective. They could not permit the dollar exchange rate just to melt down. So if they had permitted the dollar exchange rate to fall, there would have been a very strong incentive for investors to quit the U.S. capital markets and to invest in Europe, which might at the short run seem to be an enticing prospect. So I say, why shouldn't they like to do this? But actually, it's not such a good idea, because then the question is how to invest all this money, knowing that the problem is ultimately a financial or monetary one, that is a temporary one. So if they invest and start investing this money, let's say in medium and long-term projects, and after the crisis is resolved in the U.S., 1, 2, 3 years, it will stream back to the U.S. capital markets, which are, after all, very attractive in comparison to European capital markets, then they would have the inverse problem. So the euro exchange rate would fall very dramatically as compared to the dollar, and this would entail even stronger incentives for people to go out of European capital markets. So you have kind of an extreme overshooting on both sides that could just swing back and forth indefinitely. So they have a very strong incentive to stabilize the exchange rate. So whenever the Americans increase their money supply, the Europeans must follow. They must make sure that the exchange rate doesn't vary too much. That's exactly what they've done. So some of the greatest increases of the money supply were invested into so-called currency swaps, currency swap agreements, which boils down to the fact that the Fed gives a credit to the European system of central banks, and the European system of central banks returns such a credit in euros to the U.S. so that both central banks have the possibility to use this foreign currency to stabilize their own exchange rate on the forex markets.
What about the Bank of England? I mean, what's
Similar thing. The bank, England is of Great Britain is a smaller country, but it happens to have a very large capital market, so it's part of the gang, so to say. And the Brits did not follow quite as a conservative policy as the Europeans or as the Americans, though they were way more expansionary and were punished by a stronger decrease of the exchange rate. But still, I mean, you could not let this go on indefinitely, and did not go on indefinitely. So the British pound slided somewhat, but it had to be stabilized at some point. So they're part of these agreements as well.
And what about the Bank of Japan?
Same thing.
I think of the trilateral business,
right?
Here.
I mean, so
US,
this mechanism or these incentives that I described, of course, they hold true for any central banks being associated with major capital markets. And they might not care about smaller central banks. And so sometimes you have, therefore, an exchange rate just really melting down. A case in point would be the exchange rate of the Icelandic corona, which went down the hill. So a great trouble for that country. Mm-hmm. But that's, of course, also because it's comparatively unimportant. It doesn't threaten Europe. It doesn't threaten the U.S. if Iceland has big problems. But it is a problem for Europe if the U.S. has a big problem on its financial markets and if the dollar risks to melt down. And it would also be a big problem for American policy if similar things happen in Europe. So there is a mutual incentive to stabilize the other guy. And we have here, so to say, an inbuilt interventionism creates a perverse mechanism of centralization, right? We have here very strong, powerful incentives to cooperate, and cooperation is the first step to a cartel. And they have, as a matter of fact, not a formal cartel, but in practice, they do have a cartel of central banks. And cartelization is the first step to full-blown fusion, merger, and establish one worldwide central bank issuing one worldwide fiat currency, which is, of course, what many central bankers hope to create one day, which is not yet for tomorrow, but clearly, so it is a step on in this direction.
And has this been true with the Swiss central bank as well? I mean, a lot of people have been surprised at just how expansionary the Swiss central bank has been in a league with the European central bank
exactly.
And the Fed.
It's the same mechanism, Lou. It's the same mechanism. The Swiss monetary policy has traditionally, for the past 40 years, roughly, so since the end of Bretton Woods, had oriented itself towards the stabilization of the Swiss franc exchange rate. So it was a slight increase in of the exchange rate over time, but never a dramatic one that would have given a strong incentive for investors to leave the major capital markets and put on in Switzerland. Because then the problem is you have, again, this hot money, and what do you do with it? right? And so what the Swiss do with all, so they get, of course, lots of money from foreign investors for tax reasons and others. So what do they do with this? They reinvest all this money abroad. So Switzerland is, if you wish, a huge channeling country that doesn't invest all this capital in the country itself. It couldn't. And it couldn't. Mm-hmm. But reinvested elsewhere in order to prevent, and always at the same maturity as they get money lent.
Well, you know, let's say that in a fantasy world that you had a bunch of Holzmanians in charge of a central bank, whether it's the Swiss central bank, obviously it's not going to happen with the European central bank or the Fed or the Bank
poor
of England,
soul of
but
the
a smaller, a smaller, you know, what would they do in this world as it exists at present?
Yeah,
and assuming the U.S. is not going to nuke them for having a descending monetary policy, or the Saudi Arabians or whatever, are they actually compelled to go along with the world regime? Is there nothing they can do?
Yeah, of course there are alternatives. I mean, for example, they could introduce some sort of currency competition in their own country. As long as there's some national sovereignty, you are free to change the law and permit the use of different currencies on your territory. You would have currency competition. You could also try to make your paper money convertible again into some basic metal like gold or silver.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a return to a gold standard or a silver standard. So these are options that do exist. Of course, they are unpopular with governments because fiat money is a major source of government finance.
Yes.
Not necessarily directly. It's not necessarily the case that the central bank hands over money from the printing press to the treasury, right? And they then spend it, but so it works indirectly. They provide refinancing for the financial markets, and there then credits are generated for the government, right? So these guys then buy government bonds and treasuries, treasury notes, and so on.
John Maynard Keynes, of course, talked about, in his view, the need for a world central bank, a world fiat currency, so that there would be worldwide inflation and there'd be no escape. And this would be, of course, a wonderful thing. Is that what we face?
Yeah, I think ultimately there are very strong forces pushing in this direction. It's part of the logic of the game, right? It's something that past economists hadn't seen quite as clearly as we do today, because now we have the experience of the actual operation of a worldwide system of competing paper currencies, and we see what the forces are. That is something that I describe in my book that you mentioned, the Ethics of Money Production.
Yes.
Right. So there is this tendency for them to cooperate in order to avoid the negative consequences that would spring out of freely fluctuating exchange rates. So we are heading toward this direction, or everything else would not be in the interest of the central banks, right? There are only these two ways out, either centralization, or you revert back to some sort of natural money, then you wouldn't have these problems either. But that's, of course, what they wouldn't want, because it would take the tool of easy finance out of their hands.
So unless we're successful in changing people's minds, are we actually headed for a world government and a world central bank and a world currency?
Yeah, that's coming ahead. So you really, the only way out is for enough citizens to become conscious of these things and to oppose them by electing different people or whatever, changing the political regime. Right? Well, one option, for example, in Europe would be just to abolish the European Union, or at least to abolish the monetary union. Then the problem would be scaled back, wouldn't be as big as it had been before.
Well, I can remember when it was considered and damned as conspiracy theorizing, when people noticed that, I don't know, in the 60s and 70s, that David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission was actually urging this sort of thing, that there be a union between a European Central Bank, which did not exist at that time, and the Bank of Japan and the Federal Reserve Bank to bring about a world currency and eventually a world government. Mm-hmm. So are they getting their way?
Yeah, I think so. The interesting thing is that this comes about not necessarily because the guys who were conspiring to create such a system were successful in convincing everybody. That I think that's not the case, but because the logic of the system is such that it creates these incentives to go that way. That is, even people who are not from the outset sympathetic to David Rockefeller's ideals of world government and so on, they step by step they are drawn onto this way because it's the least evil or the least bad from their narrow perspective of governments, looking for easy finance on the one hand, trying to avoid trouble of a financial monetary sort on the other hand. So that's the way to go. In Austrian economics, we have the theory of spontaneous orders. So many phenomena emerge as a result of human action, but they were not designed, right? Not of human design. It's a famous quote from Ferguson that Hayek and others always bring up. And we have such a case here too, right? Not all spontaneous orders are benign orders, right? So the market economy is of course a benign order, but there's also a perverse or cancerous spontaneous orders. And an international monetary system is such a spontaneous order too. It evolves spontaneously once out of a thoroughly interventionist system. It brings people step by step toward this result, even though they didn't necessarily want it.
Well, if we want to fight against this cancerous spontaneous order, if people want to learn more about the subject of
money,
I mean, what should they read? They need to read The Ethics of Money Production, your book, but what else?
I think the best book to start is Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money? The title is a little spectacular, maybe, or What Has Government Done to Our Money sounds is an accusation coming out of this. But what it is essentially is an excellent introduction to monetary theory. That's what it is. And I mean, even if you don't agree with Rothbard's political views and his aspirations, you still should know this book because it explains better to you than any other book the basic concepts of monetary theory and how a monetary economy operates and what the stake of the government is in it and why it's the various monetary interventions have had a negative impact on the operation of the system. So this is something that you need to read. Then it's nice to mention my book. I wouldn't recommend this necessarily as an introduction, but as somebody for somebody who is already acquainted with Rothbard's book, let's say this, I think it's a good addition. And then you can go into various directions, gaining more insight in particular questions. There's a great book out by Jesus Huerta de Soto, is a Spanish professor in Madrid.
Yes.
He has written a big book, also published by the Mises Institute, Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles. It's a wonderful introduction into business cycle theory. It's in fact not an introduction, it's a treatise on business cycle theory and on fractional reserve banking. And then, of course, there are Mises books. There's the Theory of Money and Credit. Mm-hmm. There are the chapters on money in human action, so Mises' main treatise, but also in Man, Economy, and State. Rothbard has written a very long chapter, about 100 pages on money, which everybody should read once he has sufficiently advanced. And then also I think people who are really interested in this should acquaint themselves with the history of money. It's also a very important subject. So again, here Rothbard has written several important works on this. It's the history of money and banking in the United States. There is a wonderful little book written at the beginning of the 19th century by William Gouge. Is this the right way to pronounce his name?
Yes, you know, it looks like Gouge, but he pronounced it Gouge.
He pronounced it Gouge, okay. Yes. Yeah. So a short history of money and banking, of paper money in the United States. Wonderful covers of the history of the colonial period up to the early 1900s. And Gouge was the main, let's say, intellectual inspiration of President Jackson at the time, who did two very heroic things. he abolished the central bank of the time, the second bank of the United States, and he got rid of the public debt, just giving a blow to fractional reserve banking. It was a wonderful person. Well, of course, he had many flaws also, right?
But when, from money and banking, he was great.
Money and banking is my favorite politician of all times.
Go Andrew Jackson, at least in those areas.
Exactly.
Well, Guido Hulsman, thanks so much for coming on the
show. It's a pleasure, Lou.
Read the books that Guido talked about. Murray Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money, to begin with. And then Guido himself, and Gouge, and Jesus Huerta de Soto. So there's a whole pantheon of great writers on the subject of money. And these developments are very alarming that are going on in the world. So first thing you have to do is educate yourself.
And then educate others.
Guido Hulsman, thank you.
Thank you, Lou.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. Thanks for listening.